Hi again, everybody. John Porteous of the Lovells Township Historical Society here, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Hey, welcome back, everyone. A lot of fun for you today. Richard and I are sitting down with Dr. Ben Jones. Ben is the president and CEO of the Ruff Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society. A deeply seasoned forester and wildlife biologist as well, so we're going to have a lot of fun talking about a lot more than just going out and hunting grouse or woodcock. So even if you're not a hunter, I think you're really going to pick something up and enjoy this. So here we go. Without further ado, let's talk to Ben.
Hey again, everybody. It's John and Richard, and we're with Ben Jones of the Ruff Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society. Ben, welcome. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Doing really well. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a pretty day where we are, and I think we're hitting you in central PA?
Yeah, I'm in central Pennsylvania. It's absolutely gorgeous here, maybe 68, 70 degrees. The sun is shining, so it's just a beautiful late May day.
That's the way we like it. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we were talking before the podcast a little bit. We've had the good fortune to have another of your staff, Glenn Blackwood, on with us in the past. But just kind of as a refresher for our listeners, Ben, would you kind of reintroduce RGS and AWS to folks?
Absolutely. I'd be glad to. So the Ruff Grouse Society, we it's actually been a couple of years ago, 2021, we had our 60th anniversary. So RGS was formed in 1961 in Monterey, Virginia. And a lot of people don't realize that RGS was founded in the state of Virginia. And from its original founding, the tenets of the Ruff Grouse Society have always been sound science in wildlife management and in forest management. And the founders started RGS. You have to figure this was 1961. Wildlife and forestry research was still a pretty young discipline at that time. And so they were really interested in learning more about how to conserve habitats and how to manage habitats, not just for ruffed grouse, but thinking about ruffed grouse as a flagship for all forest wildlife. And that has been the core of what we do for over 60 years now, is always advocating, promoting, and delivering good forest and wildlife management based on the best available science. So, you know, that's the crux of RGS for 60 years, and it's more true today than ever.
Well, I love it, and I don't want to glaze over that. And I guess even the newsletter is named Bellwether, but the Ruff Grouse really is kind of the canary in the coal mine, isn't it?
It sure is, and there's a lot of different ways to think about it. Another way is that it's a fitting ambassador for forest wildlife. Ruff grouse only thrive in diverse, healthy forests, and they're non-migratory. We'll talk about their wonderful little buddy, the American woodcock, here in a bit, which, of course, is migratory. But with ruff grouse, they're indicators of what is happening where they live. And ruff grouse populations are reflective of forest health where they live. So, yeah, in that, they're a bellwether. They're an ambassador, a flagship species, or, you know, this canary in the coal mine that can give you some insights into if things are going in the wrong direction. They can be that canary in the coal mine.
Well, and I'm going to let you guide our expectations. I think we're maybe a little spoiled up here in Michigan and throughout the upper Midwest, but not everybody are enjoying good numbers of birds. And I guess maybe we use that to kind of bleed in to some of the areas of your focus and kind of where you're centering your attention or how you center attention, maybe, because you do have regional divisions, right?
Yeah. Well, We're centering our attention across rough grouse range, and especially east of the Mississippi River. And, you know, there's this whole vast expanse where rough grouse, they call them ruffies. A lot of people call them ruffies out west in the Rocky Mountains, where rough grouse occur west of the Mississippi. And we hope to start working out there very soon as well. But our focus really is everything east of the Mississippi. And so in the early 2000s, state wildlife agencies were required by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to develop what were called state wildlife action plans. And those plans were to be each state agency's blueprint for wildlife conservation. An important part of those plans was they listed what they called species of greatest conservation need. So species of concern, if you will. And rough grouse are listed in 19 state wildlife action plans as a species of concern. American woodcock are listed in 28 state wildlife action plans as a species of greatest conservation need or a species of concern. So, I mean, right there, that talks about the importance and the timeliness of our work. And just to go a little bit further on that with rough grouse, it was just a report came out from leading upland bird and grouse biologists in the East that was released late in 2020 that really documents across much of rough grouse range, they've experienced a 50% on average decline. And in some parts of their range, so we can talk about where this is in a bit, we're looking at a 70 or 80% decline over a relatively short time period, certainly within our lifetimes, only looking back about 30 maybe to 40 years, having a 70 or 80% decline. So there's where you think about the rough grouse and the canary in the coal mine and you say, okay, what the heck's going on here?
Well, and based on what you're saying, the word back from them is it's bad. Let's do something.
Well, yeah, and that was the purpose of their report, because each of these agency biologists were seeing these trends in their states and seeing grouse completely disappear from parts of their states. And I'm right now with you in central Pennsylvania, where the rough grouse is our state bird. The only state with rough grouse is its state bird. And there are counties here where rough grouse are extirpated, where just 20, 30 years ago, rough grouse were common to see while hunting. And now they're gone. Not just declined, but they're gone from parts of their range in Pennsylvania. And I think even in Michigan, when you look at population trends, and you're not feeling it so much in the northern part of the state, but in southern Michigan, I hear about this all the time, of places that used to hold birds but no longer do, even in southern Michigan.
Well, I just speak, you know, in this area, you know, we're around Grayling, above Grayling. Mm-hmm. I can remember 10 years ago, I looked out the back window of my cabin, and there'd be a dozen birds in the yard. And, you know, and now, I mean, you just don't see them that much. You have to actually go out and look for them. And the guys, the successful hunters are the ones who come up during the year and do their scouting and find out, you know, where they're at and how to find them. And they're just not here like they used to be. I mean, it wasn't unusual to go out to drive and see four or five of them crossing the road.
And, you know, with the grain of salt, of you always expect a little bit of nostalgia, and you know, the things through the storyline aren't ever as good as they used to be. But I mean, this is a common enough theme, and it's backed up by data that yes, across most of their range, rough grouse populations have declined considerably. Yeah.
Or what? And then Ohio and Indiana are about to go on the endangered species list. Is that right?
Well, in the state of Indiana, I guess it's been over a year now, they were put on the state endangered list. And, you know, this was just the trend over time. They reduced hunting seasons, reduced bag limits, then closed hunting seasons. And then the next step was the state endangered listing in Indiana. And you have to remember that Indiana, I mean, grouse weren't rare there. In the early 1980s, seen figures where rough grouse were one of the most commonly hunted and harvested species, maybe second or down on the list from white-tailed deer. So to have nearly lost rough grouse in Indiana is, man, that's a wake-up call, or it should be.
It's really a sad commentary because I was born and raised in central Indiana, and it's just, it's a totally different deal. It's nothing at all now like it used to be. It's just really
and
bad.
It's habitat driven, and it's two kind of things. One, across some of that country and other places, like I was mentioning in Pennsylvania earlier, where it's complete forest lost to development. I mean, what used to be forest or grown up pastures or old fields that held birds is now development. It's gone. And the forest that's remaining, and this is where we're really active right now, the forest that's remaining hasn't been managed well. So that's something we can fix. We can't fix when habitat is completely lost to development.
And once they build a house and asphalt it, it's gone, man.
Well, yeah, it's the old Joni Mitchell, Bay of Paradise, put up a parking lot. But there's more to it than that, Ben. And you yourself, I believe, come from an extensive forestry background. Can you elaborate a little more on some of the techniques that we can employ and some that are being used and how you guys are doing that?
Yeah, sure. Just a quick bit about my background and how I came into this. I, like so many of our members, grew up hunting with my dad and uncles before I was old enough to hunt, and was just always passionate about it, and enough so that took a career path. And I started out at Penn State studying wildlife biology, and pretty quickly learned there I wanted to work on habitat management, that forestry was going to be a really important part of that. But a lot of times, the wildlife biologists and the foresters weren't speaking the same language. So at that point, I kind of combined those two and did a dual career path in both, with one foot in the wildlife realm and one foot in the forestry realm. So my career and interests have always been on forest management for wildlife, and worked for 5 years on a rough grouse research study in the state of North Carolina, which is similarly, maybe it's surprising that the Rough Grouse Society was founded in Virginia. Somebody may say, there are rough grouse in North Carolina? That there indeed are, in the southern Blue Ridge Mountains, above elevations of about 2,500 feet, healthy grouse populations, although one of those areas is seeing the 70 or 80% declines. But anyway, I worked down there with the Forest Service on thinking about management for rough grouse and how to manage forests, and then made it back to my home state of Pennsylvania, where I worked for almost 15 years with our state wildlife agency, and at the point where I left there was habitat division chief, so overseeing all the public lands and our private land management program. So yeah, I've been in this for about 20 years with, again, this focus of having one foot in the wildlife and one foot in the forestry realms. So several things over that couple decades are really important. One is that dozens of species, and rough grouse are a representative of these, require diverse structural forests. And that structural diversity comes from having different age classes of forest in close proximity. So you've got young forests, maybe 1 to 20 years after some kind of a disturbance, whether that's a wind event or a timber harvest, and then forests in that kind of 21 to 40 or 50 in different stages throughout. That's a healthy forest, and good forest habitat has a lot of different age classes. And if I drove from where I'm at right now to visit with you guys along most of that route, all I would see along both sides and along the ridges is forest that's about 100 to 120 years old predominantly. And that's a function of, if we can get into a bit of the history here, considering our platform today, that's a function of what happened, give or take 20 years of the year 1900, when most of the timber resources in this country were overexploited. And that, of course, gave rise to the conservation movement. And we can talk some about that, but fast forwarding ahead, what we've got today is kind of this unnaturally single-aged forest that's 100 to 125 years old. And our way to fix that, then, is through sustainable forest management, to intersperse timber harvests and intersperse our age classes through harvesting timber sustainably over time as a way that we as managers can make sure that that forest diversity is there for grouse and dozens of other species. Grouse, other species, whitetails. You know, the number of whitetail, people interested in hunting for whitetails compared to ruffed grouse is it's a factor of, I don't know, 10 or 20 or more. But the same is true for whitetail deer. And if I'm looking at a 1,000-acre property or 100-acre property, and landowner A wants to manage for grouse, landowner B wants to manage for whitetails, my management plans are going to look very similar. So that's kind of the long and short of the habitat management piece.
Well, and again, it's a lot more complex than just knocking down trees. I mean, I guess I'm going to go back for a second. You know, we've got almost like this bathtub swamping scenario where, you know, basically everything in Michigan was leveled, you know, from to your point, now we've got 100 to 120-year-old, you know, forests around, still mm-hmm. actively, you know, harvested and such. But how do we cut down on that? How do we move to that model from where we are to where we need to be?
Well, again, one of the key pieces that has determined in my career in this realm over a couple of decades, our ability or inability to be able to get that management done really depends on forest product markets. So to be able to cut that wood, and you know, this also plays into what we were talking about earlier with development. If there are good wood product markets where landowners can sustainably realize some revenue over time from that land, then we know that they're less likely to have to sell that land for development or for other revenue if they're able to realize some revenue through timber harvest. So this is where the forest economics and the forest product markets really enter into our ability to manage on the ground for wildlife habitat. And in Michigan, certainly compared to some other places, you still have pretty robust and diverse forest product markets, especially for the lower grade wood. You know, not talking about like veneer grade. When I say low grade, a lot of times wood that's used for pulp, you still got pretty decent markets in Michigan. So we're able to get this work done commercially. You know, and forest management is a bit different than other types of habitat conservation. If we look at creating grassland habitat, for example, we are paying through a large public bill, the farm bill, we're paying commodity ag producers to take a product off the market and to let it grow into habitat. When we're doing the forest management work for forest wildlife, that habitat work is actually putting a commodity product on the market. So it lets us look at things in a different light, and it opens up a lot of different potential. But that potential is really based on products for markets for those forest products.
That's fascinating.
Well,
yeah, it's an intertwined and very interesting world. And, you know, and for the 10-year-old kid that's dreaming about being a wildlife biologist, you know, I hadn't thought at that point that I'm going to have to dive into, you know, forest product economics. You know, I thought I was going to be out tracking moose from a helicopter somewhere, but nonetheless, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, it does underscore a completely different dimension that, to your point, probably slips off people's radar when they think about this.
Yeah, and the historical context, I think, is really important, too. The word conservation, I think everybody that enjoys the outdoors and is passionate about conservation should really look up where that word actually came from. And the word was created by Gifford Pinchot, who of course is one of the founders of forestry and forestry as a profession, and Theodore Roosevelt's right-hand person, who gave birth to conservation and conserving our forests. That word, core to that word, and core to the success that Gifford Pinchot and Theodore Roosevelt had was protection, and not just protection of forests, but protection through use. And so they talked about how the strength of our young nation, still young nation at that point, depended on the wise, sustainable use of our forest product resources. And that protection through use was core to the word conservation that Gifford Pinchot created. And so that's more relevant today than ever, that we protect forests by making sure that they can be sustainably used. And this relates to landowners being able to keep their forests in forests. It relates to state agencies that hold large public land bases that can use revenue from those sales to invest and additional land protection. That's a really important historic context of conservation.
It's cool that you point that out. And I guess I wonder if does the pendulum ever tick the other way in that regard? Do we have to, do you feel that there might be areas, parks, whatever, that we may need to conserve by roping off because we have embraced them too hard? Or I'm kind of thinking about gridlock at Yellowstone or some of the other places like that.
Well, you ever been buzzed by one of those tour buses? You understand that pretty clearly.
Yeah, so again, the history of this is fascinating, but you know, this was kind of the battle for the hearts and minds in protecting wild spaces. And you have the two figureheads, kind of where Gifford Pinchot, this protection through use, and John Muir, who was taking a more preservationist set-aside mindset. And from those two very relevant approaches came the national park system that's on the preservationist side, and 192 million acres of the national forest system that's protection through use. So yes, both of those things are absolutely relevant. And that dichotomy or that difference in mindset is kind of reflected in how national parks are air quote managed versus
right.
How our national forests are mandated to be managed.
Very cool. I didn't want to go too far off into the national park thing, but some important parts relative to the complexities of forestry and forest management. Maybe we turn that focus a little tighter and get back specific to the grouse and the woodcock in that regard.
Sure. Where do you want to go?
Well, I guess maybe we should keep it at the national level because I know you've got some great people available that can speak on our, you know, more local level. What are some of the big success stories right now as far as RGS goes?
Overall, and I'll relate this to Michigan, to right in your backyard here in a minute.
Okay.
But overall, our interactions and cooperation with the U.S. Forest Service has really come a long way over the past couple years. And the Forest Service is a giant agency, 193 million acres with lots of challenges. And the one thing that I definitely learned from my time in public service and managing public resources is that nonprofit partners can really help you as an agency get work done that otherwise would be very difficult. Partnering with nonprofits gives you a lot of flexibility. So for example, here's one example. When I was in our state wildlife agency, we had a good amount, a good uptick in our federal funding from Pittman Robertson. But at the state side, during the recession, the state was on a hiring freeze, so we couldn't hire, we couldn't get trucks, we couldn't get new foresters on the ground, but we had this really nice pot of federal money that was available. So what we were able to do was with our conservation partners and sign into contracts with those partners so they could fill those staff needs and get them in trucks and we could have people out there working on the ground. That's the same approach that we're taking with the Forest Service. There are a lot of challenges to staffing and having people in the right places. All the attention and staff needs that go to wildfire anymore, that pulls from their ability to manage those forests close to home. So we can enter into contracts with the Forest Service to help them build that capacity and hire staff. And we're doing that right now in Michigan. We've got several new staff positions hired in Michigan. We've got an agreement with the Huron-Manistee National Forest to help them work on the Zone Aspen project, which is about 30,000 acres of sustainable aspen harvesting over the next decade or so. So nationally, our capacity building and working relationship with the Forest Service going forward has been really exciting. And you can see where that comes down to things in your zip code, like the work on the Huron-Manistee. Or if you're in Western North Carolina, work on the Cherokee and the Nantahala National Forest. Or if you're in Vermont, work on the Green Mountain National Forest. So nationally, that's really been exciting. And it's something that comes to roost and is tangible locally.
That's really exciting. As you, in, I guess, one last kind of forestry strategy technique question, if I may. How is that practice evolving with the climate change? We're, mm-hmm. you have to look through a different lens and say what used to be a certain climate range is now that and more, and the trees that were once species in that area, but now maybe we have to look at something different over the next 60 to 80 years.
Oh, absolutely. When we look at changing conditions and our forests responding differently now than they did to the same kind of treatment 60 years ago, I mean, that's something that that's the core to us keeping up on that scientific understanding what's going on out there, not with just with forest response, but with wildlife response as well. And I think ruffed grouse are a great example of that. Ruffed grouse is a, air quoting here again, are a northern species, but they still occur in places like North Georgia and Western North Carolina at higher elevations. So rough grouse are one of the most climate-imperiled species in North America. So, yes, we need to stay cutting edge on that research and understanding how the changing environment is impacting the forests and the species that live there.
Are we seeing changes in the woodcock migration patterns?
The interesting thing about woodcock, and these, man, close to my heart, and, part of the thing as a wildlife scientist that I love so much about woodcock is we don't know as much about woodcock as we do about a lot of other critters, ruffed grouse included, white-tailed deer. We're only just now getting a handle on woodcock migration because of our ability to put little GPS transmitters on them. Previously, we couldn't track them from point A to B to C and their migration routes. But if you want to check out something really interesting, just do a quick Google search for Eastern Woodcock Migration Study. And there are maps on there. We've been supporting Eastern Woodcock Migration Study, putting transmitters on birds for the last 5 or 6 years. So you can go on there during the migration periods and see where those birds are moving up and down the eastern flyway. So we're just now I don't know that we ever even had a baseline, really, for woodcock migration. We're just now learning all kinds of things about them that that we never knew before because of technology.
That's pretty exciting.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, as a group that really wants to make good, informed management decisions based on science, our ability to work with the University of Maine and State Wildlife Agency partners to get the woodcock migration study rolling is, that's just really key to our business model.
Just a question. I've been told, or I've always thought, conventional wisdom, air quote again, turkeys and grouse don't habitat well together, and we've seen a hell of an increase in turkeys around here in the last 15 years since I've been here. Is there is there any basis to believe that?
Turkeys and grouse have some overlapping similarities in habitat needs, and then there's also that part of the Venn diagram where they have differences in their habitat needs and also differences in the way that they're responding to environmental change. So a lot of what we're seeing with turkeys, and if you look at Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, the death knell for turkeys is an extended period in the winter with several weeks of deep, fluffy snow. They can't get out of the trees. If they get down, they're stuck in the snow. Extended periods of deep, fluffy snow is lights out for turkeys. To the contrary, the only weather factor, this includes wet springs and everything else, the only weather factor that's ever been scientifically connected to rough grouse survival in a positive way is the presence of deep, fluffy snows in the winter. So that same thing that lends to rough grouse survival, deep, fluffy snows for long periods, and lends to turkeys really taking it hard, how many, comparatively over the past decades, how many periods with long, deep, fluffy snow do we have in these areas compared to what we used to have?
Having fewer of that. It snows and it melts here, yeah.
So those environmental changes in many places where y'all are at, for one, is allowing turkeys to kind of expand their populations to seemingly expand northward. And it's having the same kind of detrimental effect on rough grouse at the same time. And similarly, turkeys can adapt much better in those older, kind of single-age, older forest conditions. They do need the young forest, too, for nesting and brood rearing and optimal habitat. They do. But they can make a better go of it in places that don't have quite that level of diversity that rough grouse need. So all those things are kind of happening simultaneously that often leads people to think, well, A equals B, there's more turkeys, less grouse, or turkeys like eating grouse. But that has never been shown to be the case.
Hadn't heard that one.
Let me introduce you to that one. I have heard that one a bunch.
The closest I came to that one is they disturb their nest and crush their eggs.
That one goes around too, or eating chicks, or kind of just more of that direct competition, which really doesn't seem to occur. And in really good grouse habitat, we can see them coexist very well with turkeys, and both populations do well.
Well, yeah, that was the question I was trying to get to.
It's going
to
take us. On one side of the house, I've got a couple of grouse that, you know, hang out in the summer and drum, and on the other side of the house, I've got a parade of turkeys that come on to deer.
Yeah. There's more.
That's true.
That's a question I had.
Well, Ben, what's the call to action for our listeners?
Oh man, this is my time to kind of give. Suggest marching orders. This is
exactly.
A good spot
we'll
to be in.
Right up here.
You know, I I think one of the things would be what I talked about earlier is just to really understand or think a bit more or do a little bit of digging or read some of the great books that are out there about birth of the conservation movement and Gifford Pinchot and what conservation really means and how we can sustainably manage and actually protect things through their use. So just to learn a little bit more about that and through the lens for your listeners of really interesting history of the birth of that movement. And the other, of course, is to become a member of the Rough Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society. You know, for half of what it would cost you for an evening out to dine or the fraction of the cost of a round of golf, you can become an RGS member and receive our magazine, learn more about what we're doing, and most importantly, help support our work.
But just in addition to that, you got a good shopping opportunities too, because I'm looking around the room and I see about four prints that I've bought off to
it. Yeah, man, that's a good deal. Go buy some stuff too on our website when you're getting your membership.
Well, and let's not forget, outside of the seriousness of the mission and the science, it's also a very nice opportunity to gather and meet some neat people and with shared interests and expose yourself to some new folks.
It absolutely is. And, you know, this is one of the final words I always want to leave and extend it right now to your listening audience, presumably many of whom will be in central Michigan or throughout Michigan, is just to thank our members, our chapter volunteers. We just came off of a really great local fundraising season. So it's those chapter volunteers that pull those events together. It's members who buy their tickets and go and support RGS locally. So that means everything to the work we do. So thank you.
Well, and, you know, Richard and I can attest to this, you know, up here in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula, most of the RGS chapters will host sporting clay shoots throughout the summer to stay tuned up for the fall season. So, again, have a little fun, meet some cool people, and raise some money.
Well, the watchword around here is you can't fly fish all the time. You got to take time out for bird hunting, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, well, there'll be shoots, so check out the Rough Grouse Society website for different events and the proceeds. When you're looking at shoots, most of those proceeds stay with that local chapter. So that's awesome too, when you can have the combination of large projects that we're supporting from a national level coming together with funds raised at those local events. I mean, that's a win-win. And you're going to go meet some people who are into the same things that you're into. So that's always a benefit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Ben, you've been very generous with your time and sharing your knowledge and stories with us, and we're most grateful. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I thank you. It's great to have the opportunity to get the word out and to talk about what we do. And, I mean, clearly you guys both love all of this, and it means a lot to you as it does to us. So thanks so much for the opportunity. It was my pleasure.
Right. Outstanding. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, take care.
Well, there we go. A lot of fun, great conversation with Ben. Hope you guys picked up some stuff. I certainly did. Just a quick reminder, museum's open this weekend. We'll look forward to seeing you if you're in the neighborhood. If not, stay tuned to the podcast. We'll be back next week. And until then, mind your backcast.